first going to take a look at a pretty important case that was delayed this week in the Supreme Court. And this involves that new Texas law that would give Texas police the authority to arrest people they suspect of coming into the country illegally, even miles away from the border. For more information on that, I talked with former State Attorney General Rob McKenna.
The state legislature in Texas passed a law called Senate Bill 4, which allows Texas state law enforcement to arrest illegal migrants, basically for trespass. They would be charged with a misdemeanor and sent back to Mexico. If they're arrested a second time, they can be charged with a felony. And a federal district court judge in Texas struck down the law, actually temporarily blocked it by issuing an injunction against it. But the standard for issuing an injunction is whether or not the judge thinks that the challenge will ultimately succeed on the merits. It's called likelihood of success on the merits. So that judge has clearly signaled that he thinks the law will be struck down, and this is under a concept known as the supremacy clause, right? That in a conflict between state law and federal law trumps. And here we have a lot of federal laws governing immigration. This judge suggested that means that Texas cannot arrest people for crossing the border illegally. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the preliminary injunction, didn't rule on the merits of the law or its constitutionality per se, and found that the law should be allowed to take effect while the underlying legal challenge proceeds, right, until we get to summary judgment. The U.S. Supreme Court has weighed in, and this is all happening very fast, right? So it was just a few days ago that the federal district court judge issued the injunction. But the U.S. Supreme Court has overturned the Fifth Circuit and is not allowing the law to go into effect, but at the same time is saying, well, it might go into effect on March 13th, but that suggests the court's going to rule on whether the law is constitutional. Sorry, that's a bit complicated.
But yes, it is.
This has been happening very quickly. A lot of courts involved, and this is on what's called the Supreme Court's emergency docket. So everything's been happening very fast.
So who enforces this? You have two basically armed police forces. You have the Border Patrol and you have the Texas National Guard. Whose job is it to usher who out of the way?
Well, you have competing constitutional theories. The state of Texas and its governor, Greg Abbott, who I served with when he was attorney general, is arguing that the Constitution allows a state to defend itself from an invasion.
Right.
And so he's saying this is an invasion. We get to defend ourselves. On the other hand, the Constitution gives the power to the federal government to control our borders. Right. So it's pretty obvious that given all the federal immigration laws, we don't have state immigration laws. Right. They're all federal. And it's notable that the legislators in Texas who crafted this bill closely copied language from the federal immigration statutes about illegal crossings and the way they set this up. So it sets up a direct conflict. If a state believes that the federal government isn't controlling the borders, can it step in and do the border control itself? The federal government has sued to say that Texas cannot do this, but Texas is fighting hard because they have a serious problem right now.
We're hearing from former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. And if you follow this issue at all, you know that Texas Governor Greg Abbott uses the term invasion when he refers to the migrant crisis at the border. That's deliberate because it is basically mimicking the use of that word in the Constitution.
He's arguing that because of the language in the Constitution, which says that states can defend themselves from invasion, that they've decided in Texas that there is an invasion and they're allowed to defend their borders. So that's his argument. But again, it runs into a lot of federal law, which is based on the concept that the federal government controls immigration and is supposed to be policing the borders itself without state participation.
Well, under the court's interpretation of the 14th Amendment, where you have to prove insurrection, I would think that Governor Abbott would then have to undertake to prove invasion before he could invoke that clause, right?
Yeah, I think his argument has problems and is not a promising argument, in my opinion, because we simply don't let states unilaterally interpret key provisions of the Constitution. What is insurrection? what is supporting or aiding insurrection, right? This is the whole point of the Colorado ballot case, right? We're not going to let one state decide who gets to appear on the national ballot for president. And so I think that the state of Texas is unlikely to prevail here on that theory of invasion. And I think the federal district court judge probably got it right. I mean, someone was born in Texas, in San Antonio, you know, and I still have a lot of family down there. I'm sympathetic to what Texas is dealing with, but of course it's affecting the whole country. And one of the arguments against Senate Bill 4 is that, you know, it could be used to arrest somebody who's found in North Texas, right? And not just on the border, and that it'll result in racial profiling. There are all kinds of complications that arise. But the problem they're trying to solve is very straightforward. The federal government has not successfully, or even, you know, in a meaningful way, in many people's views, attempted to interdict these large numbers of people who are coming up and claiming asylum, and they're being released into the country and showing up in big cities and small communities.
You know, if this philosophy prevails, I recall back when we were seeing thousands and thousands of Californians coming into Seattle. There are people who just wanted to stop them at the border. Could you redefine that as an invasion and invoke this clause?
No, probably not, since you probably couldn't credibly claim that other Americans moving to your state constitute an invasion. It's the idea of people coming from a foreign country. And you know, read the bill, Senate Bill 4, what they're saying is it's a crime unless you cross through a legal port of entry, right? Uh-huh. So they're not trying to stop people from entering the country as long as they come through one of the legal ports. It's when they cross by wading through the Rio Grande River, for example, that they're saying that would be illegal.
Any idea how long this is going to take to resolve one way or the other?
I mean, it's possible the Supreme Court will rule on the constitutionality of Senate Bill 4, this Texas law, by the beginning of July. That I could see that happening.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Choke points.
Let's go.
Legislature's about to adjourn. Chris, have they come up with money to finish the 520 bridge?
No, they have not. And the session ends at midnight, and plans to expand tolling on 520 to help pay for finishing that construction is fading. The Senate, as we've talked about, passed a bill last week that would defer sales tax payments on the future construction over Portage Bay. It would also allow tolling from I-5 to Redmond, the entire stretch of the freeway. The current law only allows tolling on the floating section of 520. Well, the House Transportation Committee took up the bill this week and then changed it. The committee stripped the expansion of tolling from the bill, choosing only to go forward with deferring sales tax payments. So why'd they do that? Committee Chair Jake Fye says there just isn't enough information about what tolling the entire corridor would do to congestion, to traffic patterns, and to revenue.
We need to take a look at sort of the whole picture of things and make sure that if we go forward with segment tolling, that we don't cause other congestion problems, other places.
Researching an expansion of tolling on 520 hasn't even started. Washington State Transportation Commission Executive Director Rima Griffith told the lawmakers that this kind of analysis would take a while.
We do think there is value in beginning that assessment, given those do take a couple to maybe 3 to 5 years to really run through, vet, do public engagement. So it's not a fast process.
I got an email late last night that's saying that the Washington State Transportation Commission will actually start discussing the idea of investigating the expansion of tolling at its meeting next week. They just kind of added that to the agenda because this has just kind of come up recently. Well, the full House passed this bill last night, but it has to go back to the Senate for reconciliation because, right, the Senate bill has tolling. The House bill does not. Just hours to go, so we'll see where this goes. So it looks like the tolling 520 from Seattle to Redmond will not be in the mix right now to help fill the nearly $600 million shortfall in the Portage Bay expansion project estimates. State Rep. Andrew Barkas says finding that money in the overall budget will not be an easy lift.
This has been a monumental task this session, working on this particular piece of the budget and knowing how important this is to our region, but also the challenges that lie ahead when it comes to looking at the resources that are available.
And so, as Matt Markovich likes to tell us, our legislative reporter, now we get into how the sausage is made and where we go from here, because it's not likely that the legislature is going to put a solution to the 520 funding into the transportation supplemental budget, which is going to come out and have to be voted on and passed by today, because it's become very clear that the strategy in Olympia is to tie that 520 funding to the very unpopular Climate Protection Act, which has raised the gas prices by over 40 cents a gallon, thus forcing voters to make the choice in November. Do you want funding for 520 or do you want lower gas prices? That's what the political campaign against the Citizens Initiative is expected to be. As it stands right now, plans to finish the 520 project are really in limbo.
Well, I mean, the question is, do you want a free lunch? And if you want a free lunch, you got to pay for it.
or you could fund these things on the front end and then, like we're supposed to do with education and transportation and law enforcement, and fund those things first.
Yeah, but that means you got to cut everything else.
Well, that or maybe a little bit more judicious with the money you have.
Well, you could stop the fish culverts. You could stop the
Well, you can't because that's illegal.
Okay,
that, you know, that's
that.
Under a legal.
All right, we could cut teacher salaries, which we just raised, and take the money away from that.
Well, again, no, that's part of the stuff you need to fund on the front end.
So we can't do any of that. So it sounds like we're getting down to people who use the facility have to pay for the facility.
Potentially, and they did a little quick little survey of people when they talked about this. The people who live along that corridor said, yeah, we wouldn't mind paying if it meant you finish the project.
Excellent.
But again, problem solved. People who drive that only from, say, Redmond to 405 might not be so interested in that because they're not using the Portage Bay area. So
problem is these roads were built by the federal government basically for free.
And correct.
We think we should. Now, growing up on the East Coast, you pay for every mile.
That is totally true. So the question becomes, yeah, if that's the way we want to go, great. I mean, let's put that out there because, yeah, I don't mind paying toll roads if they pay for the facility that they're supposed to do. So we'll see where this goes. But yeah, only what time is it now? Six? Seven, so yeah. We have, 18 hours until the session's supposed to end?
They'll come up with something.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
Let's talk about the Washington State Department of Transportation, which has some explaining to do because one of its former employees has filed a lawsuit against the agency. Cairo News Radio's Kate Stone is here. And what is this about?
Well, its former employee says it has some explaining to do. If you listen to the state's version, they think that they've done everything by the book. So it's kind of a back and forth. But essentially, we kind of talked about this in December, which is when Scott Smith, a former economist for WashDOT, filed an initial complaint. He says he was forced out of his job, forced to retire early because he made predictions that the state's Climate Commitment Act would raise gas prices by around 45 to 50 cents. According to him, he was tasked with early last year creating a revenue forecast, essentially, that would estimate how fuel prices would be impacted by the state's climate laws and other factors. And he says he estimated the 45 to 50 cents, but his managers at WashDOT and state officials from the governor's office and the Office of Financial Management said, and he says, he quotes here, they would prefer that he not include those numbers on the official report. And he says that that's something he would not do.
They asked me to do something that went right. I didn't do it. And they told me they'd lay me off. So they eliminated my job by legislative sleight of hand.
And he says this is especially relevant because he personally is actually in favor of the climate laws. He says they reduce carbon emissions and he actually is in favor of it. But he says the math is the math and he wasn't going to, in his words, jimmy the numbers. Now, if you listen to the state's version, they say, and I've talked to a spokesperson from the governor's office, Department of Ecology, they say that he never worked on this revenue forecast that he's talking about. They didn't work with anyone from WashDOT on this. The Department of Ecology is actually the one that calculates the impacts from the climate laws and any other impacts to fuel prices and transportation costs. So they say he wasn't really involved in the thing he says he was involved in. They also said, a spokesperson from the governor's office said that the Office of Financial Management staffer that Smith says told him they would prefer, you know, the numbers be hidden, has no record of that conversation. And
so he's saying he just made this up, made up his the responsibility.
You know, they didn't say that.
They
didn't say that in so many words, but they also said that there was a state law passed last year that would have eliminated his job anyway. His position would have become redundant, and it would have gone to another council within the state. So he was already, you know, going to be phased out essentially. Mm-hmm. But Smith says they did that on purpose because of his predictions. They went to the legislature and got his position removed, and he says the final straw is when he was allegedly denied leave to visit his elderly mother over Thanksgiving. He says he retired in November. He filed a whistleblower complaint the same day. That was not the lawsuit. Now he has filed the lawsuit seeking monetary compensation. He has sued WashDOT and the governor's office are both named in the suit. They are seeking unspecified damages. It is important to note he's being legally represented by the Citizen Action Defense Fund, which has publicly opposed the Climate Commitment Act. Yeah. It's filed multiple lawsuits against it, and it is a conservative advocacy organization.
Okay, but he was right about the prediction, correct?
Again, you would have
right
to.
I
mean, Sully went toe to toe with the governor about that very issue.
Yeah.
So, on this show, you would have to. It depends on who you ask. I mean, the governor has consistently said it is price gouging by the oil and gas companies.
Let's keep this simple. Did the department do a cost analysis when they developed this plan?
Not one that they've publicly shared.
Not that they wanted to do. And he's saying he was the one tasked to do that?
Tasked to do at least a
version
of it.
And they're saying the Department of Ecology's job was to do that.
Correct.
Did the DOE do anything?
Not that they've shared.
No. Huh. Well, that I'd be interested to hear that. So if they're saying that was the DOE's job and they didn't do it, I'd be curious to know who bottled it up there. In terms of this guy, are they saying that he was basically insubordinate? Is that what they're saying?
They're essentially saying that his claims of retaliation are vastly overblown. They say the whole not being able to visit his mother thing is because he was a keynote speaker at a very important conference, and which conflicted with his leave request. So it was essentially, it was not retaliation. It was simply a scheduling conflict. There's a lot of explanations for each one of the claims that he makes from the state. It's hard to tell exactly, you know, where the mm-hmm. facts are. It could come out in court or it could be settled long before that. But it's another sort of stage or spotlight for the Climate Commitment Act, which, again, is on the chopping block in November. Voters will decide on it. It will be on the November ballot. And it's sort of highlighting this back and forth debate we've been having for months
right.
between the governor and the state saying, you know, gas prices have not risen because of this act, and the other side now being highlighted by this case saying, yes, they have.
Okay, well, as long as it's going to be on the ballot, then we deserve to know all the information necessary to make a decision. Have the oil companies open their books so we can see their profit margins and determine if, in fact, they could have afforded to eat the difference.
That bill did not make it out of the legislature.
What bill is involved? The companies would want to reveal that to show how honest they are.
There was a bill from Senate Yeah.
Don't laugh at my question.
No,
Scott.
I mean, oil companies have never been known for their wanting to open their books.
Let's give them a chance.
Sully has something
Sully
to say.
Is,
he
yes,
is
Chris,
waving his arms
yeah,
wildly.
Just according to AAA today, mm-hmm. just so we can lay the groundwork, the average price for a gallon of gas is $3.40 across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's $4.08 to $4.17 in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Our neighbor to the west is 85 to 90 cents cheaper in our east in Idaho. Montana, another almost dollar cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Oregon is about 30 cents cheaper today. So that's just the playing field
now,
in terms of mm-hmm. the prices and
yeah,
where
but
they
who sets that price? The company set that price, right?
True. In defense,
so then the gouging must stop.
In defense to Governor Inslee. In defense to Governor Inslee's position, the Oil Price Information Service, which is a nonpartisan federal agency, has said that Washington fuel suppliers have enjoyed historically high profits mm-hmm. in Washington, especially in Seattle. It is about $1 of profit per gallon.
Right.
And that is fully on them. That has nothing to do
there
with
you
us.
Go. So you could see where an industry group that wanted to really embarrass the governor could sort of get together and say, okay, we're going to target
Correct.
Washington State. Not saying that happened. I have no evidence whatsoever. But we could settle this by just opening the books and finding out.
But
right?
this lawsuit is saying that no matter what the profit margin is, mm-hmm. because of this law, you're still paying 50 cents more. That is the crux of this argument that he's making, and he's saying he lost his job over it.
Well, since you're bird-dogging this story, your next call should be to the CEO of the oil companies to give them the opportunity to show that they've been truthful.
Yes, I'm sure they would love to hear from me.
Yeah,
you could knock on the door at Anacortes. Just go up there. I'll get you directions.
I do love a good
knock
drive.
Knock on the door at Anacortes and say, hey, how you guys doing today?
You know, Sully, you could do that. You could live report from the roads.
Why don't you both go?
Yeah.
It sounds like a very nice
road
I've done
trip.
That. Their office is way behind a big, long fence.
Cairo News Radio road trip. I love it.
Kate Stone, thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
And the Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. This story caught my eye because my youngest daughter, who's about to turn 5 in May, she has, I don't know, I lost count, 200 stuffed animals. Whatever you think is a lot, she has a lot. Small, big, cheap, expensive, donated, secondhand. Some came from my childhood. Some came from my husband's childhood. One stuffy is so precious, we had to put an air tag in it just in case it ever goes missing. And it does. I don't know. She tends to put Lovey in weird places, and I always have to ping the air tag to find Lovey, but it's important to her. When she was a baby, I remember we'd look at the monitor after she'd fall asleep, and she had placed all of her stuffed animals on top of her, and you could just see her arms sticking out. She likes to be buried in them. I can't imagine she'll ever let them go, but logically I know she'll become an adult, and she won't sleep with her stuffies anymore. So I was happy to read about a group that gives beloved stuffies a second life. Charlotte Liebling from London was volunteering at a thrift shop when she noticed a lot of stuffed animals were thrown away, just thrown in the trash. They were well-loved stuffies and wouldn't do well on the shelves, so you can understand why, but she hated to see it. So she started the group Loved Before. She calls it a soft toy adoption agency. She cleans and repairs the stuffies and then resells them online for an average of $10 to $15, and 50% of her profits go to charities such as Make-A-Wish. If you go to the Loved Before website, you'll see she not only gives them a proper cleanup, but a story, too. Lenny, for example, looks like a spider monkey, is fascinated with flight, ready to take to the skies and soar above the toy box in his imaginary helicopter. Whether he's performing daring rescues or embarking on epic toy adventures, he's always ready for high-flying fun. Just don't ask him to land anywhere near the toy cat. Very cute. She says, for the past 5 years, Loved Before has collected more than 60,000 stuffed animals that have gone to new homes rather than the landfill.
Well, Stuffy has an air tag.
Stuffy has an air tag. It used to be my air tag, and then I donated it to Lovey, and we sewed it inside of Lovey, so she can't remove it. Nobody knows it's there. But there have been times when we've left it at daycare, and I've gone, and I find it on my air tag map, and I have to go get it.
We have two giant garbage bag size things.
She'll take
Stuffies
them.
From Tommy.
She'll take them.
That he has to go through at some point. But Socks, the horsey he got for on day one.
Yeah.
We've repaired that thing and repaired that thing, and that's still on his bed. He didn't take it to Bozeman with him.
Yes.
So he has matured a little bit. That will happen.
Lovey is
well loved. But Socks
is
still there.
Every once in a while, I can sneak it away from her to give it a wash, but it's hard.
Wow. So now, ahead of the G and Ursula show, here is G Scott to tackle the thorny issue of counter service, which is cropping up at more and more restaurants. And to assist in this discussion is our chief counter service correspondent, David Burbank, who has actually visited counters, or actually, you have actually worked counter service.
Worked many counter servers, worked many table service as well.
Okay, so this guy has deep experience on this topic. Where do you stand on counter service?
Yeah, this is a precursor to the end of tipping culture. So,
because you don't have to tip at the counter?
No, that's not what I'm saying. You do. But I'm going to get to that. But I wanted to give you the statement where I'm coming from first. In this article in the Seattle Times, the 350 readers, they polled them. 44% prefer sit down. I'm probably sure you probably to sit down.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, and 38% prefer counter service. Now, Dave, me, myself, I was kind of with you before reading the article, and then afterwards I started to really think about it, and I think I'm with the young Gen Z in them, when they want the counter service. And I'm leaning towards that. Here's why.
By the way, quick, can you guys just define, for those of us that are... The difference for those of us who are going to Applebee's. Right? Just help me
out. Right, so the traditional table service is you sit down... either there are menus already there or menus are brought to you, and then a server comes to you and takes your order, usually drink order, then dinner, then dessert afterwards. Whereas a counter service is The tables are there as a sort of just public table. There's no host that seats you. You go directly up to a counter. Sometimes it's the bar. Sometimes it's a window into the kitchen, essentially. You go up there. There's a register. There's a person there who is not necessarily a server. They are there to take your order. There's either menus up there. There's menus up on a reader board. It's sort of more of a classic, like if you were to walk into a fast food restaurant or something, and order there. And so then you either take a number, they take your phone number, they text you when your order's ready, they bring it out to you. There are a bunch of different ways that it can be done, but it's just not directly you sit down. That sort
more
of
work for the customer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So when we were all growing up, I always like to relate this into our lives. When we were growing up, when mom didn't feel like cooking, one of the famous places to go was whether it was McDonald's or Burger King. It was fast food, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. And it was either fast food or it was he or she cooking, or it was sit down somewhere. Now you got to kind of find a sweet spot of in between. You don't really want the fast food. You don't want the DoorDash or anything like that. You don't really feel like doing all the sit down. It takes a long time. But if you could do a little counter service and you just kind of cut the time in half, right? In that case, I'm for that because sometimes you don't want to sit down for a long time and wait for the order and all that. Right. You want to kind of get your food faster. And Colleen, you don't want to wait for the DoorDash because you want the food fresh. So sure. Right there, sitting down. So here's why I tell you all it is a precursor to the end of the tipping culture. Because now I bet your question is, if I sit down at counter service, how much do I tip?
Right.
That's probably the question you're asking.
What is
right?
What's the answer to that question?
Well, first of all, there really isn't a real answer to that, but it's not zero. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Normal service and a sit down is anywhere between 18% and 24%.
Okay.
Fair?
Yes.
Okay. Cool. In this case, you would probably split that in half.
10. 15.
Right? Let's say 10.
Yeah.
Let's
use, on the tip.
This
so tip
is what
tip.
Happens at a bakery near us where I will order online or you go there and you order up at the counter and then you sit down and then they call you and you get up again, you grab your... I mean, I'm doing all the work except for the cooking. So if I tip, I'm supplementing the salary of the cook.
Right.
But that's what I wanted you to say.
And you have to decide if you want to supplement the salary for that employer or tip because you're doing all the work.
Ask David. I told him that exactly
that was the
out
exact,
there.
And the exact words that you used as well. And what I think is so interesting here is with this specific tipping culture, when you go to a sit-down place and you get table service, you tip
for the
after
service.
And after all of the service.
Yeah.
At counter service, you're asked to tip before you've even received
what
anything.
What if I hate the sandwich?
Exactly.
Exactly.
I know. It's not hard,
so,
you guys.
So don't go there again.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll leave on this note. Colleen, you, it was a perfect segue.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to have more and more people saying, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Why are we supplementing the income of these folks that are working hard? Why is it our responsibility? Counter service is going to make more of those discussions.
Yeah.
That was the entire point of where I was going. Okay. By the way, I'm a great tipper. Yeah. I'm a great tipper.
So am I. I'm doing the legwork on my order. I just can't
stand tipping culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just go to the buffet.
Days
7:54.
Don't be putting $5 in your grandkids' cards. Are you still doing that?
$5 is a lot for a 3-year-old?
No.
He gives them nothing.
No, I just give her own American Express.
Oh, what?
Up at 8:45, Chris's Choke Point. We'll talk about finding the money to finish the 520 Bridge Project. As long as we're talking about the legislature, let's go to Matt Markovich, who is our expert on what state lawmakers are doing as they wrap up the final hours. Hi, Matt.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, last day 60 of a 60-day session. That's today. And as I look at the docket, nothing really big that stands out. I think they've gone through all the controversial stuff, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Two big controversial bills that were passed early in the morning yesterday. Natural gas is here to stay at least for a while. Early Wednesday morning, around 2 a.m. to be exact, the House passed House Bill 1589, known as the Clean Energy Bill, and a lot of people were tired.
We're here at 1:50 in the morning, pushing a policy that is going to have massively regressive impacts on Washington.
That was Republican Peter Urbano, representative. The most hotly contested topic was the future of natural gas to its customers. And House members were upset that the Senate Democrats did nearly a total rewrite of this bill that the House members had approved a week or two earlier. It's a very comprehensive bill that targets only the state's largest utility, Puget Sound Energy. It has 900,000 customers. Now, the original bill written by the House lawmakers provided a provision that would prohibit new residential and small commercial natural gas service after June 30th this year. No more hookups. But the Senate version eliminated that prohibition on new hookups and continued provisions stating that gas service to existing customers would continue. Now, it's a move that the bill's original sponsor in the House, Representative Beth Dozier of Olympia, approved of just before the early morning vote.
No one who currently has gas will have that removed from their home or from their business.
And simultaneously included language that would combine Puget Sound Energy's natural gas and electricity systems into a combined rate structure that critics say would raise rates. Now, Dozier says it's all about decarbonization and the eventual reduction of natural gas.
This is a big step for our state. It sets our largest utility on a path to look at how we can decarbonize in a way that protects our low-income families and at the same time make sure that our children have a sustainable planet to live on, as well as their children and their children.
And before you go on, can I just ask, is anybody there telling us how much this is going to raise energy prices for people?
The PSC has already asked for a rate increase that they're saying it's related to the CCA Act, the Climate Commitment Act.
Right.
It's a substantial rate increase before the Utilities Commission. So the answer to your question, yes, they're talking about it, but not how this particular bill would raise rates for all of us yet. Mm.
Okay.
So here's an interesting twist that happened, Dave. That's why I'm going to throw this in there. The House Minority Leader, Drew Stokesbury, he is a Republican from Auburn, in a carefully scripted legal exchange with the House Pro Tem Speaker, said the Senate rewrite of the bill is constitutionally flawed. Now, last Thursday, the president of the Senate, a Democrat, Lieutenant Governor Denny Heck, called the Senate version of the bill, quote, a hot mess, and brought up some of the same constitutional issues that Stokesbury brought up. And critics say this is going to, like you said, it's going to increase prices and will hurt families who are already overburdened by utility prices. Here's House Minority Leader Jim Walsh.
The working people of this state are tired of hearing big promises of decarbonization, but then having to live with the effects of bureaucratic fees that drive up the cost of living. We must stop this bad policy.
Well, they didn't stop it, primarily the Republicans. But seven Democrats did join all the Republicans in voting against it. Still came out 50-45 and now goes to the governor for his approval. But, Dave, it may be one of those bills that he has to think about twice because it's not originally what he had hoped for.
Mm. All right. What about speed cameras?
Now, this is really interesting. There's been a couple speed camera bills out there. They approved one that would put cameras on work zones on highways. That was universally accepted. This one was not. There's a provision in a controversial bill authorizing the use of speed cameras, and it subjects police cars to speeding tickets even when they're responding to an emergency. Now, it's Senate Bill 2384. It's heading to the governor's desk for approval after the House passed the democratically sponsored bill 55-38. It's a party line vote. It's a vote they took just before the natural gas bill. Now, original bill passed by the House on February 12th gave authority to cities and counties to deploy automated speed cameras, primarily in work zones. But after passing the House, it went to the Senate Transportation Committee, chaired by Senator Marco Elias from Edmonds, who rewrote the legislation and added many other uses, leading critics to say it's more about traffic, it's more about revenue than traffic safety. Now, Elias says the expansion is about reducing speed and saving lives. He estimated that in 2023, over 800 people will come out that 800 people were killed on the roads in the state. Now, the original version of Elias's rewrite said speeding infractions could be issued to any type of law enforcement vehicle, fire engines and ambulances. But fire engines and ambulances were removed from the final rewrite.
and the law enforcement vehicles responding to lights and sirens, but could still be ticketed. Now, here's House Transportation Committee Vice Chair Representative Andrew Barkus.
Law enforcement vehicles going through in these areas and getting a picture taken on their way to a traffic stop or to a fire, and they're not exempted. They're subject to the fine. That makes absolutely no sense to me.
So Senator Phil Fortunato, Republican from Auburn, tried to remove that provision that allows for ticketing of police, but then he pulled the amendment with a sarcastic comment.
Senator Leas has assured me that since the police are the ones reviewing the cameras, they will then be able to determine whether they want to give themselves a ticket or not.
So it's... Yeah. So and he raises a great point there, because that's how it can work.
What does that mean? So one government agency is sending money to another government agency?
Well, you could ticket if a guy from Auburn, a police car speeds through Kent.
I guess.
Kent can ticket the Auburn police officer.
Okay.
You know.
And Auburn police
It's all up to the cities and counties. They'll decide.
I don't get it. What was the justification? Was that just a mistake, or do they really, really wanted to do that for some good reason?
No, that's on purpose. Because
to discourage chases? Is that what...
Well, that's implied that police in these speed zones, and they could be school zones or work zones, if an officer is flying through there, lights and sirens, maybe that's not a good thing, according to Senator Lee.
No, that's a good point, but I don't know. Do you have to find a cop to know that it's not good to hit a child? Come on.
I'm just reporting what it says.
Okay.
You have to make the decision whether this is good legislation or not. How about that? but real quickly, and I'll kind of wrap it up here. It's a wide expansion of the traffic safety cameras. Cameras mounted on Metro buses can be used for infractions, for stopping and standing in bus zones. Any city with a rapid transit corridor can use safety cameras to ticket people. The ferry system and cities can use the cameras that look at ferry jumpers in the line. Those cameras now can be used to ticket people. It really expands it, and the tickets can't be more than $145, double if it's in the school zone. And if you are in public assistance, you get a break. You can ask and will be granted upon request to reduce the ticket by 50%.
Okay.
So there's a lot in this bill, and you can read about it on My Northwest.
Matt Markovich, thank you, Matt.
You're welcome, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM, or subscribe to this podcast, and you'll never miss the show.